ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Stee Thompson, CEO and founder of Powster, an award-winning creative studio in London responsible for all six major movie studios, showtimes, and movie platforms. Known for developing and creating interactive video content, Powster's services range from web-based virtual reality experiences to music videos and interpreting 3D filmed content. For people who aren't aware of your amazingly creative and innovative company, can you please give the audience the view from 50,000 feet?
So Powster's a creative studio. We've got offices in Los Angeles and London. And we've been working with the movie studios and the music labels and coming up with all sorts of creative products for them. And we've won a lot of awards along the way for the things we've built for the entertainment industry. But we, one of the biggest things, one of our biggest products now powers most of the movie websites worldwide, and it's white label, which gives us like a great access to all the movie studios, and it lists all the showtimes and cinemas on that. So we've pretty much one of the only companies doing it now because we had the best product, and there's a lot of traction from the studios loving it. And yeah, it's been going since 2009. And 2 years ago, I sold half the business to Vista Group, which is a technology company for cinema and film. It's a bit like a Silicon Valley of cinema.
Okay.
Which is pretty exciting. So we're 50-50 partners now in Powster.
Wow.
Yeah, I got a ton of opportunities from that. So.
Well, I imagine that feeds sort of perfectly into some of my questions for later in our conversation. But first, since you started in 2009, I'm sure you've seen some trends and changes in the way that films are being marketed and promoted. What would you say is the most significant change you've seen over, let's say, the last 3 years?
It's definitely that when we started out, Facebook was pretty new, and most of the movie websites would be these massive, sprawling, flash-based, interactive sites that would have you could spend an hour on there and still not discover all the content. And over the years, it's kind of moved away from creating an atmosphere for the film and more towards functionality and providing utility to the users. And a lot of the more video-based and content has moved to the social platforms. So it's meant that in the past, as a creative studio, you'd be making really luxurious, crafted websites that were, to be honest, also very expensive for the studio. And nowadays, it's more about providing utility to the customer and helping them get to the trailer, helping them see which cinemas are showing showtimes, and providing a tool to the marketing team at the movie studio. But that's like a massive shift, and it's happened across like quite a few different verticals, not just movie studios, but less of a reliance on a website for discovery, and more of that discovery is taking place on social platforms.
Well, right. I work with networks, broadcasters, and cable channels here in the US. And one of the things is the method of discovery has moved from their own pipe of their channel to these social platforms, which can be a mixed blessing depending on how the algorithm is running and changing, and also getting the skill sets up in terms of what engages with audience and knowing those things. Do your clients typically come to you armed with data?
They do.
Or is that not part of what they're doing?
They do, but it's more like we're the ones arming them, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah, no, it does, because that was actually one of my questions. I would guess, and I could be totally wrong, this Vista Group, is how large your data science group is. Like, how much of that is part of your business?
Yeah, sure. So it's quite an interesting answer because at Powster, we build the pages which list all the cinemas and showtimes, which gets the studio some really good information on, you know, which cinemas people select, which showtimes people like, which advertising is performing correctly. And we have like a data dashboard for them so they can see which ads are doing well, which ones didn't get many people to click showtimes. And doing that worldwide where there aren't any major ticketing aggregators in some countries. So they get an amazing amount of data from our platform, and they'll also put their own pixels on there to feed it into their own data pools. They'll aggregate everything across all their properties. And then as part of the group of companies, there's actually a company called Movio, and they're a sister company to Powster, and they're the real data scientists. They have like a team of data scientists, and they work directly with the cinemas and get all the data from the cinemas, and they work with the movie studios, and they're pretty much like a bridge between the movie studio and the cinema when it comes to data. So at Powster, we tend to focus on the tool for the studio and the collection of the data for the studio. And then Movio are really the guys that dive into the data world to monetize that for the cinema and provide value to the studios and stuff.
Right. But a lot of what I looking at your work, which, you know, I understand it's not perhaps as luxurious the websites as they once were, it's still stunning visually. And I'm curious, in terms of developing your creative, what is the relationship between your creative group and your data group? I mean, do you, for instance, Netflix does a lot of A/B testing. Every aspect that touches the customer is A/B tested to see what people are responding to. Does that figure into what you're doing as well?
Yeah, for sure. We build about 100 to 170 movie websites a month, and we get, in last year we had 422 million visitors.
Oh my gosh.
So we've got a lot of data on user behavior. So we can very quickly, you know, go in and see, is anyone even using the map? What percentage of people use the filters? And over the years, you know, we launched the actual movie platform, you know, in 2014, 2013 kind of time. Over the years, we've looked at that data and that behavior and used that to inform our decisions for the functionality and mm-hmm. features. And sometimes you're quite surprised, you know, like you could assume that people, that there's a search box, for example, that says enter your location here. And when we looked at the data, actually what most people were typing in was cinema names. You know, they were searching for, they were putting in the name like AMC into the box. Huh. So, you know, we had to add functionality to allow that to work. We do user testing as well, where we hire, it's actually, you know, like a user testing service where they'll have people that will test your platform and you watch them and they know that you're watching.
Right. Like, it's sort of creepy otherwise.
It's a paid for thing. These people get paid, but they kind of go in blind and they go in and they try and use your platform and you see all the areas where they get stuck or where they really enjoy it. And so there's quite a lot going on there, but yeah, we do definitely dive into our data to help inform a lot of the decision-making. And that's mostly for our functional products. There's a whole other side to the business, which is more creative at heart and labs-based, which is oftentimes doing new stuff where there isn't really any data to work with, but we can still take some of the learnings from all our experience across our other properties. But yeah, the labs-based area is kind of a little bit more of an experimental ground, doesn't have as much of a foundation on data to build it. So we've got kind of two sides going on. We've got a giant product that is evolving over time that we use data and, you know, user testing to help improve. And then we have a labs and creative team which are constantly trying to come up with new things and experiment and, you know, figure out what is the best user journey on Facebook Messenger, for example, etc. So yeah, quite a range.
I saw on your Twitter that you have isolate audio on Facebook video 360 so that if you orient a certain way that the sound changes. I mean, have I got that right? First off, I want to make sure I'm describing it properly.
That's right. Yeah. That's a
how on earth did you decide, I know we're going to tackle this particular challenge? And then this was out of your creative labs group. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
tell about that.
Okay, cool. So we get a lot of projects from the music industry as well. So we've done a lot of music videos, full production from treatment all the way through to shooting it and editing it and then putting it online and making it interactive. A lot of our music videos are interactive. So we've got a great relationship with the music industry, and we were approached by one of the labels, and it was actually for John Williams. And we were like, oh, awesome, because this kind of crosses over into the movie world. And they wanted to create a way for people to preview the album and all the classic songs but from John Williams in a really quick, easy way on Facebook and make it interactive and engaging. So we thought, okay, great, a 360 video looks really good for that kind of thing. And we'd put all the props from his iconic films. You know, he did the music for Indiana Jones and Jaws and, you know, Star Wars and pretty much any epic film you can think of. But yeah, so we made a scene with all kind of like shadows and kind of animations for each of his films around in the 360. And Facebook has a built-in realistic audio engine for 360 video now. It's really cool, actually. The key word is realistic, is that, you know, if you had four speakers around you, each playing, one playing Indiana Jones, one playing a Star Wars theme tune, you'd hear them both. Even if you're facing the Indiana Jones one, you'd hear the Star Wars one really clearly in your ear on the left. So that's the default approach in Facebook, is realism. But we were trying to do something different here. And, you know, we pushed the realistic boundaries as much as we could, using the Facebook tools to like make the audio go as quiet as we could, suppress non-directional sound and from the sides. And it only went so far. And, you know, we take on a lot of projects where we're experimenting and we have theory but have never done it before. Nobody's ever done it before. And we just try and figure out how to make it happen and how to make it work. And so while we were doing this, like, we were like, it's good, it works, but it's not quite good enough. We were kind of brainstorming how we could solve the problem we had, like the audio leaking through. And me and Leo are chatting through it, and we came up with the idea of noise cancelling. So the theory is that if you play waveforms in reverse over the same channel, it'll actually cancel out those noises. And we only knew it by theory, but, you know, it's part of the labs team. So we're like, okay, let's dive into this world. And, you know, Leo spent a long time researching into how noise cancelling works, like getting his head around it, learning about waveforms. He's never done that kind of work before, but, you know, we kind of dive into it and we learn it. And then we actually managed to came up with a way to cancel out the other channels using the theory of noise cancelling. So it meant that when you were facing Indiana Jones, that we'd play essentially the reverse waveform of the other audio that's going on without Indiana Jones, to cancel out just those waveforms. And that's how noise cancelling headphones work.
Right.
So yeah, so it's like, it's pretty much like having like a real technical foundation across the company, and everyone kind of, most people I'd say like would be classed as a little bit geeky, but still probably, you know, creative geeky, that style, and having like a load of different skill sets where, you know, when you're presented with these challenges under the labs team, you can usually come up with a solution for them.
So when you came up with a solution though, I mean, you've got this engagement from this client. Do you say, we're going to try this thing and hope it works? Or do you sort of have your standard approach, and then in the back, you're trying this new thing, and then you say, well, or we could do this, you know, how, I mean, at what point, you know, and how long does it take? I mean,
yeah, we have a reasonable level of confidence, and there is explained at the start that, you know, this is something that hasn't really been done before. It might not actually be physically possible, but let's try and do it. And it's an exciting space to be in, because, you know, you could be working on something for 5 days. In fact, I think Leo was trying to get the sound cancelling to work for a long time, and it's only on the last day that it worked, and you can imagine how happy he was. There's no better feeling when you do that kind of work, you know, and you have a discovery and you crack it and it works. So it's super exciting. And the client's kind of along for the ride on that as well, you know, like we've done some real out there stuff that's not sure if it would work, and then it pays off. And we've had quite a few clients that have got promotions off the back of projects we've done, you know.
Well, sure. Like, imagine like you hit the KPI perfectly for them, do something nobody else has done, and they're made. So when you develop a tech like this, is it proprietary? I mean, can you automate it? Is this something that you can add to your toolkit, which you develop for other people, or is it work for hire for somebody else, and so you don't own that tech behind it?
So it varies across different clients and different agreements. We've got some technology which we've built in-house through making music videos or experimenting or having ideas, and that stuff we own, and we can apply that to projects to do world first, so that it's our IP. And in other instances, yeah, the studio or the music label would own the IP for the technology. In this case, it's more of a technique. So we actually, you know, you read the blog post on it. So we actually released it so that anyone would be able to do it. And, you know, part of our logic for doing that is to, well, of course, like give back a little bit to the other vendors who are working in the same space, who are like part of the creative community. But also kind of, you know, shows like people who are looking for work, like this is the kind of place Powster is, like, and they right. can kind of, you know, so it helps. So although we didn't
it's branding, you're thought leaders.
It's true. I mean, we although we don't own the technique, we could still get a ton of value out of it. And, you know, there's other stuff where we do own the technology, and then we apply it to a ton of different things. Like we've got this VFX breakdown tech and interactive video tech that is our own tech. And we've done a ton of projects with that for all different clients. So yeah, again, it kind of varies on the project. But sometimes we'll create some awesome IP, and as part of the rationale behind having a labs team.
Right. No, it's fantastic to have that. It's so exciting. Now, going back to, we talked about how social content was sort of, or social platforms were one of the most valuable ways for publishers, entertainment publishers, music publishers, to drive awareness, audience growth. Do you have opinions about what platforms are the most successful when launching a new entertainment property? And are there any trends that you see emerging?
Yeah, sure. So part of that timeline from where it shifted from owned destinations to having your property promoted inside another platform, part of that shift was due to mobile. The limitations of mobile web meant that a lot of the more engaging content could only be done natively on these platforms. And, you know, the app builders knew this, and, you know, you can see social networks slowly strategically releasing new forms of media. So you see Facebook releasing video and then Twitter doing it at the same time. You know, it wasn't long ago where you couldn't even post a GIF to Twitter, you know, and then they become the best way to consume that video content, because, you know, it has an audience there, and then it plays really nicely. And, you know, same with 360 video. The 360 video thing we did for John Williams wouldn't have been possible if Facebook didn't start doing 360 video. So almost these platforms are becoming gateways to what's possible technically. They're kind of controlling the type of media that goes out, and, you know, they're all jumping into AR now. That opens up those doorways.
Right, which you actually are doing some really interesting things with AR. I mean, jumping around about, I saw something where it was AR and it was the locations and it was real time. You know, I often ask people about VR and AR, but you're already putting it to use. Can you describe what you're doing there?
There's a pattern I've seen with these providers. Just transitioning from the last question, the providers basically release new technology, get everyone hyped about it because it's awesome, and then they switch to monetization through advertising. So you never quite know when you get into a new tech like AR how it's going to be monetized. You can kind of guess, but at the point before it gets monetized, it's just an awesome thing. Like, and it gets pushed massively because they want it to be successful. The same thing happened with live video. You post a live video to one of your pages and it would get huge exposure, you know. So everyone starts doing live video because that's how you get exposure. And then it kind of, and then there comes a point where it gets monetized and you have to pay to play. And then that's where it kind of shifts. And then it becomes about ad buys rather than, and still need great creative. But so AR is in this really awesome honeymoon state right now where nobody's really done much with it. So there's tons of world firsts possible. And it's also not really been monetized yet, other than like shopping tags or linking out. There's not any major monetization yet. So it's a really great space to play in. And when we look at new technology like AR or VR, we've obviously got like a really good creative focus on it. But we're also looking to provide value. We're not looking to just make something gimmicky that's cool because it's AR. We want to try and use that technology to do something you couldn't do without it. So AR Showtimes allows the user to scan a poster from within the Facebook camera and it will show you all the showtimes for that movie. So say you pointed your Facebook camera at the Mission Impossible poster, then it would show fly out and have all the showtimes listed. And there's I've got a little cool video demo on my Twitter about that.
But it's like, super cool. I mean, I was just fun. Like, this is amazing.
It's sci-fi. It's so sci-fi. And that's really exciting about it. And then with VR, like we've done a lot of web VR. I actually spoke at Google I.O. about on their web VR section about how companies can use new technology to create business models. And our web VR product lists, you put your phone into a Google Cardboard or anything like that, and you can see all the showtimes around you in VR. But the clever thing is that you can also watch the trailer in 3D. And that's something that you can't do at home normally. And there's a lot of people who in the past tried 3D and it wasn't very good because it's bad projectors or something. And the technology's moved on a lot. There's a lot of people that like naysay 3D. And it gives them just that little bit of a gateway into that world. And the 3D ticket price is higher. So, you know, the studios make more money from it.
Right. So it's a win-win. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how, like, you know, looking at these new technologies, we'd add our creativity in. So, you know, you're popping the balloons for it or something, but we'd still have at heart, like, some kind of business value to the studio, some kind of value to the consumer. And oftentimes with movies, that comes to selling movie tickets. So we're running a lot of the you know, official destinations for showtimes like missionimpossible.com. And so our VR and AR experiences naturally can bring those showtimes and interactive kind of more utility-based pieces of functionality into them quite easily. Yeah, so we've got a good...
Right, which is so important. I mean, one of the things I love is... Well, I love that you approach it in terms of not just the flash and whiz-bang aspect, but that you're concretely making the user's experience better not utilitarian, because it's obviously a fun experience, but in a way that has utility for the user.
We like to think of it as like functional design. So it has some sort of function beyond just looking cool and behaving cool and being animated and a nice fun experience. We also want to provide some level of value beyond that that helps them do something they couldn't otherwise do. I think that's like the key for new technology, is to embrace it beyond just the novelty and try and do something further than that.
Right. One of the things that you had mentioned briefly in passing earlier in our conversation was around messaging. And actually, it sounds like you are able to market inside like Facebook messengers. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we've built a messenger experience we call Movies on Messenger. And it allows people to message on the Facebook page and set a reminder. If you talked to Deadpool Doc on Facebook when it was in theatrical release, you could actually say, remind me when the tickets go on sale. But it was all done with, we went through a lot of user testing, and we actually worked quite closely with some of the Facebook team as well. But we found that typing on mobile is still annoying. And although it's Messenger, you don't necessarily need to make them actually type. And so we use a lot of quick replies. And basically, the theory is that before we'd have it so that you'd be on Facebook and you'd link out to our Showtimes page and press remind me, and then that would open up Messenger to remind. And we just kind of removed that middle step. So you go straight from Facebook and get a reminder on Messenger. And that's one part of it. But probably the most powerful bit is the organizing of friends. So you can, inside Messenger, create a group and send the link to your friend, and they can tick which days they can go. And then everyone does the same, and then it shows you the match. So you can say, should we go watch Mission Impossible? And then they tick all the days, and then it lights up on the time that works for everyone on the Saturday evening. And you can only tick the days that have showtimes nearby you. And it's just so simple. Like, you just talk, you just load, you message the bot, and it'll say, you know, what do you want to do? And it has like a list of things. You tap organize friends, and then it will give you the tick boxes, and that's it. And you press share, and you can share it to a group. And actually, we found data from Facebook says that 50% of group chats talk about movies, which is incredible.
Wow.
Like, a lot of people in these group chats talk about movies.
Well, you know what's interesting? I, again, as I sort of said earlier, that I work with entertainment brands, broadcast and cable, and I'm thinking of tune-in reminders when they have these big original dramas and they're trying to drive tune-in, the concept that you could set a reminder and that you could also create events around it, you know, finale events or season premiere events. It's really, it's interesting. Do you ever work with these channels that are not studios and are not music companies, but are rather like, you know, NBC, FX, HBO, Netflix? Do you work with them?
Probably put some of those guys in a different category. Like, we work quite a bit with ITV. So the ITV Messenger bot, which is a massive TV channel in the UK, by the way.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I do know.
Okay, cool. There's like, for anyone else listening, there's like, you know, four or five main terrestrial channels, and ITV is like the third one. But yeah, so we've built a Messenger experience for those guys. And yeah, you can do exactly that. Set reminders for tune in. And it's kind of a new area for us, television. We've worked predominantly with the movie and music industry. And it's kind of, I'm curious to see where TV takes us, because a lot of the movie studios we work with also have TV departments. So there is opportunity for us to start working with those guys, but they're so separate. Like, it might as well be different businesses, you know, like in terms of who's, there's no crossover with staff most of the time.
Right. Well, yeah, because they're so massive. I'm also curious, though, if you ever work with some of the brands that have achieved real amazing sort of status, that, you know, they have a meaning outside of just, let's say, a shoe company like Adidas or Nike, when new things go on sale, or just brands, or Apple. Do you ever work with brands to take this tech, which obviously has application to them, and to get it into Messenger in a way that is welcomed, you know, because I think a lot of people are concerned about being invasive in Messenger, but if the person is open and sort of is a hand raiser for it, it seems like it could be very effective in terms of conversion for sales or behaviors.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with your theory there, for sure. It's the thing is, we're quite focused on entertainment. So I used to work with brands when I started out. Like, I was freelancing and I had my own sole trader company before I started Powster. And I did a lot of brand work. You know, I worked for some really, really big major brands and did a lot of interactive stuff, even on Facebook as well, actually, a lot of interactive Facebook stuff. And I always found with brands that you have an enormous pot of money to work with. So creatively, you can do enormous projects. But I also always found them really restrictive creatively. the brand guidelines would just like, if I had to move a logo another couple of pixels to the right, you know, like, it's just to conform to the brand guidelines and stuff. And it just sucks all your time, your energy out of the project. It ends up being just conforming to something that already exists. And in some ways, creatively, you get that with movies, and it's conforming to a movie director's original vision of the movie. So, you know, you can't stray too far creatively from what the movie's about, or the look and feel and the tone. But oftentimes, it's awesome. They're awesome looking.
Well, right,
designs,
right.
So it's fine.
So you don't mind conforming. Well, that's, yeah, when we do launches for original content and you're dealing with the showrunners and, you know, getting their approval, it's like, it's okay, because you love the content and the brand, is, if you will, as much as the person who is, you want to be in service of their vision.
Yeah. And then you, on the other end of that, you've got music, which is a really interesting space for us, because they provide a soundtrack to whatever you want to build. So with music, there's really no visual oftentimes, especially for some of the slightly smaller artists. You know, not, if you get below the Kanye level, then you get into like a more creative level of artists. Well,
there are quite a few artists below the Kanye level, would you say?
Yeah,
I mean, that's a pretty high bar.
Yeah,
there.
It is a high bar, but you get that upper echelon of artists which have like pretty much a branding agency, and they turn into a brand.
Right.
And then you're working with a brand, right? And
you're back to the brand problem.
Yeah,
but
with a smaller artist, and you'd be surprised, it's not that much further down. You know, like it's not that many rungs down, and they can still be major artists, like doing really successful artists, but they're open creatively to any kind of visual. And then there, when we go in and we treat like a music video or a project for that, that's like complete creative freedom.
What fun.
Yeah,
that must
really
just be so fun.
Yeah. And well, the problem with that one is it's the opposite end of the spectrum to brands, and brands has loads of money, no creative freedom, and music has no money and loads of creative freedom.
you need the happy middle.
You have to have the movies going as well, I think, to make it viable as a big business anyway. Yeah.
Well, we've actually run through our time. It's gone so quickly, and I have even more questions I would ask, but I am mindful of our time. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. It's so interesting.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Dee Thompson. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.